Today, a third part of Ethical Society and Theological Ends.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
So we got things started in a conversation about a theological underpinning to Christianity. It's just sort of built into us. It's the basis of a lot of Christian ideas, a lot of Christian theology, and that is that the world is never going to be a perfect place. So we talked a lot about how the poor will always be with you. We used that phrase out of context, but theologically and historically to convey the idea. The world's never going to be a perfect place. And yet we are, as believers, a people who believe in making things better. We're supposed to. We have a moral command to be involved in the world and make a difference. And how do you do that in a world where things are never going to be perfect? And so I said, you know, from the beginning, what we want to do is figure out how we are faithful to following Christ and faithful to his commission to us, but also realistic about what that means in a world that's never going to be perfect. No matter how much we apply, we're still going to find the faults that are left in the world. We're still going to have the poor with us, for instance. Not meaning that it's bad for the poor to be here, but meaning nobody should be poor. And yet there is going to be poverty. There is going to be suffering. So what are we supposed to do? Just wash our hands of it and leave it? Okay, so we spent time talking about that. And then I said there are two different ways people try to address that problem in the second episode that we gave to this topic. One is progressively, we're going to work continuously, Whiggishly, toward an ultimate resolution to all of these problems. Of course, the weakness of that is we're not ever going to find the resolution to all of these problems, and there are other problems that came with it. You can go back and listen to the episode to figure that out. The other solution is to build on, strengthen the way we already approach things and trust that that's the best way to go forward. And so we're either approaching things by saying we need more of the same or we need change. I mean, it's pretty obvious. Those are the two big political options that are in front of us. And so we talked through both of those options and why both of them are fraught with failure. They're just fraught with problems. For a variety of reasons. Again, go back, listen to the previous episode if you want to kind of go through what those are. So what I wanted to do ultimately is arrive at this point where we can say, well, what is it that would guide, and this is what I mean by an ethic, what is it that would guide our ethic as people who say, well, I'm going to follow Jesus. I'm not going to commit to one party or the other. I'm not just going to say this policy is going to fix everything. Because no matter what we do, we still end up with some kinds of problems. But there should be something that guides my behavior in the world rather than just sitting on my hands and saying, well, the world's going to be evil, nothing we can do about it. Let's just pray and watch everyone suffer. That's not good enough. And Jesus doesn't do that. He's doing things in the world that affect people's lives here and now. And yet even he doesn't resolve all of the problems in the world. He heals certainly a person, but he leaves others without ever having touched them. He raises a woman's son from the dead because she is, as a widow, so lonely, and he wants to meet her need and more importantly, show his power over death, obviously. But he doesn't do it for everyone. People are dying around him all the time, and he only does it for that one and then Lazarus and so on. So how are we supposed to be a follower of him? How do we shape our ethic and our moral obligations, but also therefore our political obligations? You know, what do we do when it comes to society and how we impose the rule of order on others and so on? How are we supposed to see that and be consistent with our faith that Christ is the solution. He's the sovereign power of the world, and he is able to do anything. And yet, the theological reality of Christianity, that the world's not a perfect place. So where I would want to start is this, that our change, whatever's going to happen with us needs to be in obedience to what Christ teaches us. And so formulaically, I would first go to the Sermon on the Mount and just say, it's an easy way for us to look and just, what is Jesus saying we should start expecting? I know there's more to the Sermon on the Mount than that. I also know it does include this. And so formulaically, you can take it like this. This is and I'll just choose sort of what I would say is the central example of the things that Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, where he says, you've heard that it's said, and then he follows up with, but in reality, it's this, and so on. And I think it's, how we keep our promises or don't keep our promises. And so in that formula, in that way that Jesus gives it to us as a formula, as a way to understand it formally, it's this way. So in the past, it was like this. Do not break a promise. And in that sense, by the way, evil is overt. You know what evil is. You said you would do it and you didn't do it. Someone lied. Someone made a commitment and they didn't keep it. So evil is nice and overt. So you've heard in former times, from the law. Don't break a promise. That's obvious. And in fact, even in a Kantian sense, just to take a break and talk about it from my perspective for a moment, even in a Kantian sense, that's obvious because there is no meaning, none to a promise if it's not kept. The whole point of a promise is that you're going to keep it. Otherwise, you wouldn't utter the words at all, or you would acknowledge that the words don't mean anything, which means you might as well not have uttered them, right? So it's self-contradictory to make a promise not intending to keep it. So obviously, you have to keep a promise. So the evil that's overt in the example that Jesus is giving in the Sermon on the Mount is that you can't break your promises. But then he says, but it should be more than that. You should understand more about your obligations than just to keep a promise, because sometimes evil is not overt. Sometimes it is, just to use the parallel language, covert. Sometimes it is subtler than that. Evil can be hidden. So he says, so it's not just don't break a promise, but in other words, keep your oaths, but also don't make a promise. Now, why on earth would it be necessary for me not to make any promises? And so he explains why. Because we are inadequate to be able to keep all of our promises. And this is an important part of understanding our moral obligations, that in the basic formula of the Sermon on the Mount's ethical statements, we don't just not break our promises. We learn not even to make promises because we know we didn't create the earth. We don't have power over it, all the language that Jesus uses about it, basically meaning we're inadequate to be able to keep all of our promises. We don't have the power that we think we do to bring about the result that we think we can bring about. However, we can still do something. And this is the part of the formula that's most important for us in this element of the Sermon on the Mount. You've heard that it said, don't break your promises, make sure and keep your oaths. But I say to you, don't swear at all, neither by heaven, because it's God's, nor the earth, and so on, because it's his footstool. All of that, you don't own the earth, you don't own the power, so don't make the promise at all. But we can do this, but let your yes be yes, and let your no be no. Let what you say, he goes on to say, be simply yes or no, meaning, but you can be honest. You don't have to be a person who's out there swearing with oaths on this side and that side, and I guarantee you, I promise that I've got the power to do it. You can acknowledge that you don't have power to do everything and still be honest with people, still tell them the truth. And then he goes on to say, this is the close to that illustration or to that application that he gives, which is, anything more than this comes from evil. That's a weirdly generic statement to give about such a specific example, unless you understand how profoundly this is supposed to shape the way we understand our obligation to live in a world where we don't have the power to bring about all the resolutions we'd like to bring about. I'm going to put a chicken in every pot. Everybody's going to have two cars. Everybody's going to prosper. I can guarantee you the rate of inflation is going to come down. You're going to have peace and prosperity in our days because I am president. And I can say that about anybody who's run for president in the last 50 years or 200 years, probably. My point is simply, we can say all of that, but it's not something we have power to do. Or we can just be the kind of people who actually are honest. So in a formula, it is, you used to think this way, just don't break a promise. But in reality, you shouldn't even make a promise because you don't have all the power that you think you have. But you do have some power. You can still do the right thing. You can do the right thing and acknowledge that you don't have power to bring about all the results that you want to bring about. You can see why that formula in the Sermon on the Mount is so important to what we've been talking about for the last two episodes and now into this third episode. So in our political lives, how does that play out? And the way it plays out largely is in what we don't always recognize as this, but what turn out to be pursuits of power. And I don't mean by that something aggressive, you know, something, you know, manipulative. I just mean sometimes we have the ability, the authority, the resources, the wherewithal, the means to get something done that somebody else doesn't have. That's all I mean by power. Nothing complex in the concept. So we have these pursuits of power, and very often, most often, we're going to see it as and advertise it as for the sake of the common good. So I want to be in this position of power so that I can do good for people. I want to occupy a political position so that I can do good for people. Most people I know who pursue things like that do it for that reason. And I mean on both sides. They do think of it as a way of bringing about something in the common good. The problem is, and this is what we should realize from the formula in the Sermon on the Mount, inevitably, they're inadequate in one way or another. That is, and we talked about this in the last episode when we were talking about conservative ways of approaching things and progressive ways of approaching things, that inevitably you have this trade-off, not economic, I'm not being simplistic about it, I'm talking about in terms of power and how it gets played out. So that inevitably it's sort of like stepping on a water balloon. And if you don't pop the water balloon, you know, the water just moves around. You step on one place and it squirts out the other side. And that's, you know, they're really awkward to fool with, water balloons are. That's what I'm talking about with power. Oh, I think if we can just squeeze the evil out here, it's just going to go to the other side. That's what ends up happening because we don't have as much power as we think we do, even when we're exerting all of it we can get our hands on. So what ends up happening is that inevitably this move for power, this pursuit of trying to, you know, have the ability to get things done, morphs into something that's more and more covert over time. And actually, I mean to say that the opposite way. It is covert, and it becomes more and more obvious over time in the efforts that end up having to be made to maintain that power. So I'll give you an example on both sides. Both of these are going to be a little offensive to whoever was on that side, you know. So I'm just telling you ahead of time, not picking a side, going both directions. But there are, and I mean, I heard people saying this. There are people who care so much about the value of life all the time that they're willing to beat a policeman to death on the steps of the Capitol on January 6th. There's something went awry there, don't you think? I mean, and I'm not even trying to pick out ideological perfection here. Just making the point that when in defense of life, you end up taking life, there's something confusing happening. And I'm talking about a life that is circumstantially innocent. And on the opposite side of that, there are people who care so much about human respect and dignity that, and I mean that in particular on the, you know, on the side of advocating for the life and respect and dignity of women. There are people who care so much about human respect and dignity that they're willing to authorize physicians to neglect a newborn infant just after birth if it isn't wanted. Whether that's actually done or not, the advocacy for it on the basis that we care about human respect and dignity tells you how more and more overt these efforts to use power to benefit one thing can lead to the destruction of that very thing on the other side. Or people who want, and if you go back historically, especially in the 20th century, you see this happen over and over again. People who want a classless society. Classes create inequities and injustices and all sorts of imbalance in the ethical world. And so there are people, there are whole nations who want a classless society so badly that they're willing to kill an entire class of that society, which, by the way, entails identifying them as a class. And I can give one example after another in one nation after another, but the Khmer Rouge is a particularly powerful example from Cambodia in the 1970s, when under Pol Pot, they were identifying anyone who wore glasses as being part of an educated class that needed to be destroyed. If you wore glasses, you were singled out and executed because it was an indication you'd probably been educated. You'd probably been Western educated. As, by the way, Pol Pot, who was running the program, was also educated. So, regarding what we should recognize as evil, I'm not saying it doesn't exist in a pure form. Obviously, there is still just plain old evil. There's no change to murder being wrong. But believers have to come to see that, and I've said this phrase many times, that the oppressed always become the oppressors. And they don't become that. So you understand what I'm saying here. The oppressed, they suffer evil at the hands of evildoers. Oppressors are evildoers. I mean, by this is what's meant by what they're doing. They are oppressing someone. So believers come to see that the oppressed always become the oppressors, and it's not a quirk of human psychology. Wow, that's really odd. Those oppressed people got power, and they turned into oppressors. What a strange thing to have happened. It's not a quirk of psychology. It's the cyclonic nature, the whirlpool-like nature of human society. The only balanced, perfectly balanced teeter-totter. Everybody's got everything they're supposed to have, and everything's going to be perfectly even, and all things are going to work out well. The only perfectly balanced teeter-totter is the one that doesn't have anyone on it. And anybody who's ever been on a teeter-totter, I don't know what else you're supposed to call them. That's what we called them. We called them teeter-totters. The only one that is balanced is one without a rider. Anybody who's ever seen them knows. You put a person on one side or the other side or both sides, and it's never going to be perfectly balanced. It's just not going to happen. And, that's the reality of our political world. That's what we've been talking about these last three episodes. So that recognition could make a person say, well, we might as well just give up, because no matter what you do, somebody's going to be oppressing somebody. But it doesn't have to lead to a despondency or an apathy on our part, but to a different ethic, to something we actually do about it, because we can see in Christ a different ultimate need in the society. And I do mean ultimate, a higher need in the society. And I don't just mean by that, well, we'll just wash it, do some door-to-door and pray some prayers with people and everything will be fine. I mean more than that. Evil ends up being something specific in the way Christ talks about it, the way he interacts with the people that he's dealing with throughout the Gospels and so on. Evil always ends up being what otherwise normal people, perfectly acceptable people, in fact, some of the most outstanding people, what otherwise normal people do when they have power, and they end up using it for themselves instead of for others. The Pharisees, my favorite example of this, a perfect example of this, they are the most righteous people Jesus can summon to the public imagination in the New Testament. When he, remember in the Sermon on the Mount, when he says, unless your righteousness exceeds, and then he's got to fill in the blank with the highest example of righteousness those people can imagine. And he fills it in with the blank of the Pharisees. Unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will in no wise enter the kingdom of God. These are the most righteous people you can imagine. And yet, as we read the New Testament and see Jesus interact with them, they are the embodiment of evil in the New Testament. Just like in the Old Testament, the priests embody evil as the prophets write about one time after another. How on earth does it happen that this person who models uprightness, righteousness in the society became the embodiment of evil in Christ's examples? And the answer is, because they used the power that they had to exclude, and I'll say it, that what they thought of as corrupting influences. The Pharisees were the ones who looked at the people who were doing evil, and they were doing evil at times. They looked at them and they said, you can't be a part of us. You're not allowed. You're not clean enough. You need to be segregated from everyone else. They used the power they had to exclude corrupting influences. They used the power that they had to protect the system where their goodness could be safe. That's what the Pharisees were doing. They were protecting the righteousness that they believed in, that they thought everything ought to stand for, and that they believed it was their responsibility to take care of, to sort of control. And so this is what I wanted us to arrive at so that we could understand this, what it means for us. And I think it means several things, one of which is that we can't, if I could go back 40 years, 50 years, I would love to go back and talk to myself and say, hey, don't fall for this. You are falling for it. I would have responded. I would have argued with myself. My 16-year-old self would have said to my 61-year-old self, oh, that's nicely symmetrical. I wouldn't have said that. I'm saying as a fact, matter of fact, it is nicely symmetrical. At 61, I would go to my 16-year-old and say, don't fall for this. And my 16-year-old would have debated because I was a debater. I would have debated for hours with myself saying, no, you don't understand. I'm not committed to just one political cause. I'm not on one side or the other. I'm an independent. I just do the things I believe represent Christ the best. But the reality was I was being sucked. I was being hooked line and sinker all the way into this political one-sidedness that blinded me to so many of the realities of how these abuses transpire. And so I'm saying from the start, you just can't, we cannot, as followers of Christ, recognizing the world's never going to be a perfect place, but that we have to do something in it. We can't be caught up in the fantasies of political solutions. That does not mean there are no right policies. It does not mean that it's not important to have the right laws in place or for a person to be elected over someone else. It doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean it's not important. But it does mean we can't be caught up in the fantasy that says, oh, things will finally be okay now. Oh, this will resolve it. Oh, this will solve the problem. Or, well, this will make things so much better. At least we'll be able to maintain this bubble of purity that our history has brought about. We don't need to fall for those kind of fantasies. It means that no policy, even though some policies are going to be the right one to adopt, it means no policy is pure. And I mean by that, there's no policy that doesn't have complexities or problems that are also built into it. That means that we have to think about how we make adjustments from one year to the next, from one month to the next. We never adopt something and just say, oh, well, it's done now. We are always going to have to look at it and say, ah, we're going to implement this, but then we're going to find the flaws with it. And when we do, we're going to make the changes that adjust. So we'll compensate for these mistakes that were built into it, or we'll make an exception. We'll have judges that have authority to make a human decision about what's going on, and we'll recognize that some of the judges aren't going to be fair either. But it's going to be inevitable that we're going to have those adjustments and compensations and exceptions be made. And there are obvious examples of this, even to the level of the absurd. And again, I'm going to give examples on both sides here that are just so prima facie. I mean, it is, on, you know what I mean by that, on the face of it, first glance, so obvious. And yet we work so hard not to see it. And I'm saying this before President Biden had stepped out of the race. I mean, obviously I'm saying it after he stepped out of the race, but I'm making the point about what was going on with him before he stepped out of the race. But on the Republican side, and you'll remember Joe Biden's debate, right? So both sides of this are intended to use that as an inflection point. You know, on the one side, Republicans, and I, and including a lot of my friends in circle, Republicans, you know, just pretending that Donald Trump hasn't in some ways called into question or completely destroyed any confidence in his moral sensibilities. Now, again, that doesn't mean it's true about him, but there are a lot of indicators that say something's going on there morally. And yet we stand up and say, no, there was no changing of that vocabulary. No, that's not what he said. Oh, no, this is not what was going to happen. It's just so blind to say that. Exactly what I saw happening on the other side after that debate performance, when immediately people were coming out and saying, well, you know, it was a slow night and he was tired. He'd traveled. But I think it's fine. You know, I think it's good. And he actually had a pretty good debate performance. The reality that we, in looking for a political solution, can make ourselves blind to the problems that are obvious within those political solutions. It doesn't mean you couldn't vote for one candidate or couldn't vote for the other candidate, but to say I cannot even see the flaws in either candidate is an indication that we've come to rely too thoroughly on that political type of solution. More poignantly, the realization that right now fear is surging in the Jewish community. By the way, just as it has in the Arab community, just as it has in the Black community and in immigrant communities. And it's not hard to understand why. I mean, think of the atrocities against Israelis in their homes last October. But then think of the atrocities against Palestinians, not Hamas. I'm just talking about Palestinians in general, people who are trying to live their lives in their homes. And it's all justified. And I mean the atrocities against the Israelis, they were justified by Hamas. The atrocities against the Palestinians have been justified by Israel in the name of creating a power structure to bring about finally this long-awaited justice. Either in Israel, the ability to live without the threat of constant terrorism, it's a legitimate concern, right? Or in Palestine, to be able to say we can live under self-rule, self-authority, and not have this sort of two-tiered citizenship in Israel. All of that being used as excuses for some horrendous evil that has gone on. And where are we? Where are believers in all of this process? You know, when I asked that question of myself, when I was thinking through this, I thought of 2 Corinthians 4 and that language about how we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing, this is the quotation from 2 Corinthians 4, we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. In other words, like I'd like to lament the fact that I don't have power to fix the world, but that's part of the nature of our being followers of Christ, of the religion that God has given us from Judaism through Christianity. Part of the reality of it is recognizing that we don't have the power to bring about those solutions. We have jars of clay, but we have a treasure in those jars of clay. And recognize that the power belongs to God and not to us. So what do we do? Do we exert our power? Well, I've got my guns everywhere. You know, I should be able to protect everything. I do have guns. I've got them. I'm not going to use them to kill anybody. It's just not going to happen. And I'm not saying that as if I'm some kind of pure and perfect, pristine moral example of what to do with guns. I'm fine. You got a CDL. I'm happy with all that, whatever it's called now. My point is simply to say this passage doesn't describe me saying I am so firm. I'm so powerful. I can enforce righteousness in this world. This passage says we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. So we are not powerful in every way, not overcoming evil in every way. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. We're perplexed, but we're not driven to despair. That the meaning of that is we're constantly facing problems. We're constantly seeing that we haven't solved the problem, but we don't give up. We're persecuted, but we're not forsaken. We're struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus. This is not a miraculous sign of a piercing of our hands and our feet. This is a statement that every suffering we face is just us trying to follow Christ's example, who, with all the power in the universe, chose humility and defeat as his path to demonstrate how we live out the reality of God's power in this world when we're in jars of clay. So that, he goes on to say, the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies. For we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake. And he means that literally in his day, facing the consequences of martyrdom. Our lives are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our mortal flesh. So death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. I'm willing to die so that you can live. Paul, a man who stood there and watched Stephen die, experienced the power of the resurrection of Christ from Stephen's example. And Paul has been since then laying down his life in exactly the same way so that others who did not have the ability, did not have the power of God, did not see what he could do, could. So realistically, persecution is going to come to believers as well. And I think it's going to come in ways that we didn't think were possible. I would never have believed that Christian nationalism would rise to such a position that it could actually lead to a decline in the value of religious liberty in our culture. I would never have believed that was going to be a prospect for our country, not during my lifetime. And yet here I am, still alive momentarily, and seeing it happen exactly like this. This is what's going on right this moment. So what do you think comes from that? When religious liberty is not valued the way it could be, and I could talk about this for way too long, so I'm going to try to be brief. But when we don't value religious liberty, think about what that means. So if we think to ourselves, oh, well, all I want is some Christian rules in the government. I want the government to be able to say, you can believe this way, but not that way. And it's not okay for you to advertise these things to our kids in public school, but you can do these things. And I want the government to pick it out. Think about what that means when we, so I'm going to say we, I'm going to talk as a Southern Baptist here for just a second, that we as Southern Baptists, we can't get in a room with each other and agree what we want the rules to be. We can't get in a room, a convention, with each other and agree on exactly how we want to speak about abortion or agree on what we think women ought to do in church or not do in church. That's just Southern Baptists in the room, and we say we want to put legislators in Washington passing rules about gender and all of those other concerns that we'd like to see enforced because we're a Christian nation now instead of a nation that believes in religious liberty like our founding fathers established. I mean, it's in the First Amendment, for crying out loud. So Christian nationalism is a weird way of exerting power to bring about what you think is a good thing, but actually is a demonstration that we have more confidence in our power than we do in God's power. And by the way, same problem with a lot of the progressive movement, and it does bring the likelihood of persecution of Christians along with it. Neither one of them acts outside the reality of the ethic that a Christian can understand. Because we know that however we try to come at it, however good our motives are, when we're trying to exert power to maintain power, then we're always going to end up doing the wrong thing. We're always going to end up being that category of evil that we were trying to avoid. Doesn't mean that we don't care about political goals. Doesn't mean we can't participate in representative government, not by any stretch of the imagination. It doesn't mean that Christian liberalism, you know, as a government, is not better than Christian nationalism as a government, nor vice versa. It doesn't mean you can't have that argument and that it wouldn't make a difference between the two approaches. Christian liberalism, I mean the advocacy of individualism and personal liberties and so on, not liberalism like progressivism. But they both create exactly the same kind of problem. People in power creating structures maintained by people in power at the expense of the people who are under their authority. If it's with the bureaucrats and tyrants on one side, they would have sufficient resources to strip the wealthiest individuals of their resources for the benefit of the poorer individuals on the progressive side, right? Or on the conservative side, bureaucrats and tyrants beholden to those who've managed to be successful under the current structures and now support them and maintain them at the cost of those who are excluded from that wealth. So it doesn't mean we can't participate, doesn't mean we can't have an opinion. It does mean we don't pretend that our ultimate solutions lie in these political fantasies. But it does mean this for us, and I'll conclude with these, maybe 6-7 things. It does mean that we, as believers, as followers of Jesus, if we're going to follow Jesus at all, these are where his steps take us. We use whatever power it seems we have for the sake of others. And not for ourselves. Not complicated. That we use whatever power we have for the sake of others and not for ourselves. And that, by the way, means we've got to learn to have empathy. We have to actually care about other people. It's a terrible thing, but we have to learn to do it. Secondly, we remember that we can't bring the results. We can only serve. I mean, there is a reason that God says vengeance is his, right? So we know we can't bring the results, we can only serve. So we serve people. Third, we know that power, it means that we know that power will always be deployed for evil, even when it's done for good, meaning things are always going to be complex, they're going to be mixed, that some of the good we accomplish is going to bring with it something we probably wish hadn't accompanied it. And we can be honest about that. We can admit that. It is true that people suffer because we passed this law that helped all of these other individuals. We also brought some harm to these individuals. And so we recognize that. So we know that power is always going to be deployed, including some evil, even when it's done for good in the world. If, and this is the if, this is the thing that makes us Christian if we recognize this, if it hasn't already been given away before it was ever used. This is the meaning. If a person dies to themselves, if they're willing to give up the things that they were pursuing on their own, then they can be my disciple. That's the only way you can be a disciple of Jesus. And so you give away whatever power you have for the sake of others before you ever arrive at the ability to use that power. It also means that we know that the only solution to intractable problems, the ones that just stay and stay and stay, like poverty, for instance. We know the only solution to intractable problems is in God's hands. As I said a moment ago, vengeance is mine, says the Lord. The intractable problems are always going to end up in his hands, and we have to find not just satisfaction, not just contentment with that, but we have to find our resolution in that. We are always going to have to include that prayer to God that's been offered since the beginning of time. How long, O Lord, until you make all these things right? Then it does mean this. We know the solution to a person's condition, which is in our hands. The part, you know, so we see somebody suffering in this moment. The part of the solution that is always in my hands is to love them. And I could say this 30 different ways. I mean, we learn this in ministry when we're figuring out how to serve people who are victims in a crisis moment, that you don't walk up to them and say, well, let me explain to you why God brought this to pass. You know, let me help you understand, Job, what's going on. that's not the resolution that we bring. It's, you know, we've talked about it before. The ministry of presence, that language, that sometimes all you can do is just sit there with them and say, I am with you. You are not alone. I will serve you. I care about you. I'm not here so I can get something from you. I'm not here because I have the answer for you. I'm here because somebody loves you, and that's me. And beyond me, there's a God who loves you and cares about what you're going through. So we know this, the solution to a person's condition, which is in our hands, is to love them. And then finally this, it does mean that when we thought we lived in an ideal situation, it's only because we have closed our eyes to the ones who are excluded from that world. Hey, things are going pretty well for me. Let's just, you know, let's just keep the world going the way it's going. If I'm in that model, hey, I think things are pretty good here. If I hear someone complaining about their condition, well, have you thought about the race issue? Have you thought about the poverty issue? Have you thought about the inequalities at the border? If I hear somebody on the other side of that issue complaining, and I think to myself, well, what's wrong with them? I mean, I think we've created a pretty good world. When we think that we live in pretty close to the ideal situation, and by the way, sometimes that's just an indication of our prosperity and blessing, and we have been blessed. If we think we're living in an ideal situation, then it's because we've closed our eyes to the ones who are not living in that ideal situation. The ideal political world isn't one where we don't suffer. That's not it. Not for believers. The ideal political world is one where we can see the ones who are suffering and show them that there's a God who cares about them. Even in this world, where we will always have the poor with us.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.